This program is paid for by Your Radio Doctor, LLC. All opinions or statements expressed on this program are solely those of Your Radio Doctor and their guests and do not reflect the opinions of WPHT or Odyssey. Your Radio Doctor does not recommend or endorse any specific tests, products, physicians, procedures, opinions, or other information that may be mentioned on Your Radio Doctor. Always consult your own physician. Today's program has been pre-recorded.
At Independence Blue Cross, we take care of the people who take care of you. Everyday heroes like firefighters, police officers, teachers, farmers, and healthcare workers. Doctors and hospitals across the region have IBX, and they know what it means to have reliable access to care. So whether you're saving lives or just trying to live a healthier life, count on IBX, the region's number one health insurer for 85 years. Learn more at IBX.com.
Talk Radio 1210, WPHT, WPHT HD, WOGL, HD3, Philadelphia. From the Cherry Hill Volvo Studios, where relationships matter. Always live on the free Odyssey app. It's time for the Delaware Valley's first radio doctor.
On call every Saturday afternoon at 5.
This is Your Radio Doctor with Dr. Marianne Ritchie. Presented exclusively by Independence Blue Cross.
Listen, 7 months or 10 months is an absolutely exceptionally short time frame to produce this vaccine.
Your health determines your life, your longevity, and your happiness. Let your radio doctor lead the way with your medical education. Your radio doctor, Dr. Marianne Ritchie.
Good afternoon and welcome to Your Radio Doctor. I'm your host, Dr. Marianne Ritchie. A few weeks ago, our guest was Dr. Joe Camilleri from the Mayo Clinic. He provided great information about the new weight loss drugs. You may know them as Ozempic, Wegovy, Rybelsus, Victoza, Saxenda, Mounjaro, Zepbound, and more to come. Then our Jefferson dietitian, Emily Rubin, stressed the need to add a well-balanced diet with adequate fiber, lean protein foods, healthy fats, all those good suggestions. Today, we'll focus on the connection between the brain and obesity. From the Yale School of Medicine, we welcome our guest, Dr. Mireille Sorley. She's an MD and PhD, which is terrific because she not only sees patients, but she's in the lab. And that connection is exactly what we're talking about today. Dr. Sorley is a professor of medicine, and she's a subspecialist in endocrinology. Her research looks at the areas in the brain that affect food intake and glucose metabolism, and the basic science as to why some people have insulin that's not effective. And of course, the fascinating relationship between the brain and obesity. Welcome, Mireille.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you for coming. So, an endocrinologist, your work evaluates conditions related to hormones, hormones that affect metabolism, like insulin and thyroid hormones, or that affect our sexual function and reproduction, growth, sleep, all those fascinating circuits. How does the brain regulate food intake? What makes us feel hungry? What makes us feel full?
Yeah, so that's a very important question to learn to understand why people tend to overeat and gain body weight. So food intake is very tightly regulated by the brain because food intake really is tied to survival of humans and other organisms. So In order to regulate food intake, the brain really closely interacts with the rest of the body to communicate about hunger and satiety. And there are really different brain regions that are involved in that task. And they can be involved in the more homeostatic aspects of food intake or the more hedonic aspects of food intake. So homeostatic control really refers to the energy balance in the body. So how much calories are needed to keep body weight stable, to make sure that the body can perform its major functions. And hedonic control of food intake refers to the more motivational aspects of food intake. It involves how we are appealed to food, the actions we perform to acquire and actually consume the food. And it's not like these systems are really split. They really communicate back and forth between each other.
So that is such a great way to say homeostasis, our survival. Our body tells us we're hungry or we're full because we want to have, the reason we eat is to have energy to function. So homeostasis means we have all those systems intact or and communicating, so we eat enough to stay healthy. and the right types of foods, enough protein, enough calories for energy and all that. But if people think of the word hedonism, what makes me happy, or I'm going to eat that candy because I deserve it, I worked hard today. Hedonism is the motivation. What motivates you to choose a candy bar instead of an apple? Is that a pretty good way? How much my big question is, and I'm sure listeners want to know, how much of our appetite or choices are related to physiology or the hormones, the homeostasis part, versus emotion? And gee, those mashed potatoes are great. They taste just like my mother's. I'm going to have a second helping. You know, how much does physical and physiology interact or I guess, debate with our emotions? And I'm going to eat it because I want more.
Right. So you have to realize that a lot of these processes that are occurring in the brain, also related to the hedonic aspects of food intake, are not subconsciously. So what you're talking about is more like, I want that candy because I deserve it. That's more or less, you know, the level of cognitive control. So I think we first have to talk about, how does the brain communicate with the rest of the body to regulate food intake? Because that feedback between the rest of the body and the brain is really important if we're going to talk about obesity later on. So there are signals from the body that really inform the brain about the energy status and whether someone should eat or should not eat. And these signals can come from different organs from the brain. So there are hormones from adipose tissue like leptin that inform the brain about how much energy is stored and whether the body needs to be replenished with calories or not. But there are also hormones from the stomach like ghrelin, or the intestines like GLP-1, which a lot of people heard about because of the new medications. And finally, when we're eating, these nutrients are also absorbed through the gut into our bloodstream and are reaching the brain in that way and are informing the brain about food that was just consumed and that is present in the gastrointestinal tract. So that communication is really important because it's going back and forth, and the central nervous system is involved in there, and also transportation of specific nutrients through the bloodstream towards the brain. So when we are hungry, and then we're getting more to the visual food cues you were talking about, the seeing a candy. When we are hungry, the brain really gets triggered when we're seeing or smelling or even thinking about food. And when we eat, there are signals from the mouth and later on from the gastrointestinal tract that are sending messages to the brain like, hey, you just had a meal, there's no need to eat more food. So you can imagine that all of these systems are very tightly regulated and it's very complex. And there's not like one thing that is happening, you know, when you're going to eat that candy or not, or when you're going to overeat or not. It's different levels of regulation in the brain that can be affected depending on what we're eating and depending on our body weight, I guess. So in terms of emotional versus physiological control, I think that was your question, right, Marianne?
Yes. Yeah.
So we know that in people with obesity, the regulation of food intake seems to be disturbed, but we don't know exactly when that's happening and how it's happening. That's probably a process that develops over many years. And besides the hormones and the nutrients we just talked about as signals to the brain, we also know that specific eating patterns might be related to stress. So then we get into the area of more emotional eating. So there are areas in the brain that are involved in processing of emotions, like, for instance, the amygdala. But that region also in the brain also has a role in food intake. And we do know that acute stress often leads to a reduction in food intake, while more chronic stress might actually stimulate food intake. So Of course, we don't know exactly how much stress is contributing to the obesity epidemic that's going on. But you can imagine that obesity in itself might lead to chronic stress due to the mental consequences and physical consequences, and in that way might contribute to increased food intake. But it's but it's really hard to disentangle, you know, what is physiology, what is stress-related eating.
Oh, sure.
Is that answer your question?
Oh, absolutely, because I'm trying to think of a layperson. I know as a GI doc, and I've studied the GI hormones, not as in-depth as you have, but I'm sure that's what's in people's minds. Like, okay, so in COVID, I gained 20 pounds because, as you say, that chronic, that was a much longer timeline. But then I also, we talked about this the other day, and I asked, are there certain areas involving regulation of appetite that overlap with areas related to addiction? Because aren't there reports saying, so for our listeners, once again, Dr. Shirley just mentioned GLP-1. GLP relates to a glucagon. Glucagon is a regulator that tells us we're, you know, affects appetite. So these new drugs are called GLP-1s. And I was trying to be fair in the beginning and name all of them so I didn't hurt anybody's feelings. I mentioned every company's product. But GLP-1, if you're for our listeners, if we that's what we're referring to, the new drugs, they, am I right? They can suppress your appetite, and we'll talk about how, but they also might, in some cases, decrease your desire for alcohol or lessen your craving for unhealthy foods like you know, fatty foods like cheeseburgers and French fries, not that they're totally evil in small doses. But might they be used for impulse control with smoking, substance abuse,
right?
Gambling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there are a lot of areas in the brain that are involved in addiction that are the same areas that regulate food intake. And for instance, dopamine, which is one of the major neurotransmitters in those areas, plays a role in both food intake and addiction to drugs of abuse. So there is some overlap. And also, if you talk to people with obesity, or I see patients in my clinic with obesity, they tell you how much they think about food and how hard it is to resist eating food while they know it's not good for them. So it definitely has some addictive elements. I wouldn't call obesity a food addiction per se. So we do know that treatment of obesity with these new GLP-1 receptor agonists, in some studies, they seem to reduce the craving and the actual intake of alcohol, suggesting indeed that there are overlapping areas in the brain that are affected by both addiction and food intake and are modulated by GLP-1.
Well, I think it's interesting too that, and we have about 30 seconds, you mentioned the other day that even though the GLP-1s, these new weight loss drugs, in some cases are associated with a decreased desire for alcohol or fatty foods, that the opposite effect happens when people have bariatric procedures, or is it the procedures or surgery, that they end up finding an increased desire for alcohol or gambling or whatever it is they crave.
Right. So, yes, there are reports that people that underwent bariatric surgery might face addictions like addiction to alcohol. We don't know exactly how often that occurs, and the prevalence, depending on the study, really ranges between 1 and 15% after those surgeries. And the mechanisms that drive that association are speculative, but it's
exactly.
It's suggested that ghrelin might play a role, or the processing of alcohol, you know, with higher alcohol peaks after the bariatric surgery might play a role. But it's some people think it's like some kind of addiction transfer, that people were addicted to food and now to alcohol. That does not seem to be true.
Let's take a little break, and when we come back, more with Dr. Murray Surley from Yale University School of Medicine.
Thanks for listening to Your Radio Doctor with Dr. Marianne Ritchie, exclusively presented by Independence Blue Cross. If you have a question for the medical mailbag, just send a note to doctor@yourradiodoctor.net.
At Independence Blue Cross, we take care of the people who take care of you. Everyday heroes like firefighters, police officers, teachers, farmers, and healthcare workers. Doctors and hospitals across the region have IBX, and they know what it means to have reliable access to care. So whether you're saving lives or just trying to live a healthier life, count on IBX, the region's number one health insurer for 85 years. Learn more at IBX.com.
Welcome back to Your Radio Doctor. We're learning so much today from Dr. Mireille Serli from Yale University School of Medicine about the brain and how it affects how we eat and what we eat. Mireille, research shows that animals on a Western diet, high sucrose, high glucose, high sugars, high fat, can really change feeding behavior. Tell us about your research in human beings and how specific foods or certain eating patterns can really tip the scale toward obesity.
Right. So we know from animal studies that animals that are exposed to an unhealthy diet, which is high in sugar and fat, as you mentioned, they rapidly increase their body weight, and they're very, very motivated to keep on eating, even though they have enough energy stored in their bodies. And these studies really show that specific nutrients can have negative effects in specific brain areas that regulate food intake. And this eating pattern where people eat more than they need and they tend to snack more is also what we see in people with obesity. Now, we do know that consumption of specific nutrients in people is associated with weight gain. And these are nutrients that are high in simple sugars like sodas or high in sugar and fat like chips or hamburgers. So somehow consuming these nutrients make our brains prone to send that signal that we should eat more and make us prone to increase body weight. So the other issue in terms of eating pattern, and we see that in the animal literature too, is that up to a quarter of our daily calories are taken from snacking. And we have shown in humans that even in humans with a healthy body weight, if you provide them with snacks that consist of fat and sugar, and you do that on top of their caloric need, so while they're gaining weight, we see clear disturbances occurring in the brain serotonin system. And that's a very important system also in regulation of food intake. So that really shows that specific nutrients can affect the brain that then affects food intake.
Well, I want to jump in there because you mentioned so many fascinomas to me that I remember, you know, in reading some of your work, that if we say the average American diet is high in fats and sugars, fat, aside from smelling good, when I guess a mouse in a study or a human, it smells good. It feels good in your tongue. You remember the chips that were out on the market, I think in the late 90s, and they kind of lingered into maybe 2016, that the fat on those chips, it was macromolecules. After our stomach churns up our food, gets the intestine, has to be in molecule size particles so we can absorb it and send the fat for energy and all that good stuff, protein, it all gets broken. And the fat involved in that snack, the fat molecules were so big, they didn't get absorbed. They just shot through your bowel, right? So you could enjoy the taste and the smell and it felt good in your tongue. Fat feels good in your tongue. It's all around a happy experience. But if it shoots through your body and it's not absorbed, it was causing people diarrhea, bloatedness, and it was pulling lots of essential vitamins with it, fat absorbable or soluble vitamins, A, D, E, K, won't get into all that, but it ended up being it was a clever idea, but in reality wasn't so good. But I remember that when we're talking about animals, studies, and people, fatty food smells good, it feels good. And that strong response leads to more eating, and then repeated exposure and consumption can really change on a chronic basis. I thought that was fascinating in your work. But the snacking, the other thing that I gleaned from it was the same, if you have the same number of calories in three distinct meals.
Yeah, so
you don't gain the weight. Yeah, it's crazy.
No, they gained so the study was really designed to examine the effects of of snacking versus consuming the same amount of calories with the so you either had three big meals or you were snacking in between meals, but the total caloric consumption was the same. And by study design, the weight gain was also the same. We really looked at weight independent effects of snacking fat and sugar on the brain. And that's where we saw that the snacking induced changes in the serotonin system.
Gotcha. But snacking also has a major influence regardless, like you said, whether it's in some people, say the GLP meds, we don't know how they're going to react in different people. But the snacking is a major influence, whether a person's obese or healthy weight, right?
So in general, snacking predisposes to weight gain. Now, of course, it really depends on what nutrients you're snacking on. And whether you snack hypercalorically, so whether you snack and that and you induce weight gain because you're eating too many calories. Because if you're snacking and then you're not adjusting your major meals, then you're eating too many calories. But the point here really is that snacking on fat and sugar somehow changes, in this case, the serotonin system in the brain and might trigger dysregulation of food intake and future weight gain. I don't think if you snack, you know, one day a week that that's going to do tremendous harm, but it's more these eating patterns of continuously snacking in between meals that is like high risk feeding behavior, basically.
You're reprogramming your brain. Let's talk about, if we could, other factors that might explain why some people gain weight in a particular environment. What are those influences?
Yeah, so first, I think what we should touch upon, Marianne, if I may, on why food is so appealing to us. So, and what's the difference in people with a healthy weight and in people with obesity when they look at a picture of unhealthy food? Because we know that how the brain reacts to that picture of food is going to predict how much a person is going to eat. And what we see in the literature and studies is that people with obesity react, or their brain react way stronger on pictures of a healthy, unhealthy food versus people with a healthy weight. So if you show a picture of a hamburger to a person with obesity, specific areas in the brain that are related to the motivational aspects of food intake are highly activated compared to a person with a healthy weight. The brain of a person with a healthy weight, especially when that person is hungry, will still react, will still increase activity in those brain areas, but not as strong as in people with obesity. That is one factor, I think, that how the brain reacts to food cues predicts whether a person is going to eat more or less. And we know that this is different between people with a healthy weight and people with obesity. Now, other factors that might trigger food intake are timing of food intake. You want to talk a little bit about the circadian rhythm?
Yes.
You know, our body has all biological clocks in most organs, and the major biological clock is situated in our brain. And that food consumption that is not in line with that circadian rhythm in the body induces what we call misalignment. So when we're eating at the wrong time of day, that might increase our risk for all kinds of health issues, including obesity. So apparently, food signals are processed better when the timing is right. And in addition, you know, our brain is really wired to increase our chances of survival, right? And so it does this also through stimulating food intake when food is available. And nowadays, food is available 24 hours a day. Mm. So that makes it really hard not to eat.
Good point.
At the wrong time of day.
Yeah. Well, you think in circadian rhythm, for our listeners, that means that our adrenaline starts to rise in the morning, say at 5 a.m., so that when the alarm goes off at 6 o'clock, you jump out of bed and you're ready to roll
unless you're exhausted, but and then it starts to, your adrenaline starts to peter off at 9:30, 10. So your body says it's time to go to sleep now. And so you're coordinating a lot of hormones, especially the appetite stimulation suppressant. And that is so well said, that that our clock is there because it's part of evolution. It's part of survival to rest. Your body saying, okay, time to rest. All right, now time to eat. Back, I think that's how they're connected. Yes.
Yeah, that's true. And as you were saying, it's really important to induce those periods of fasting. Our body needs time, you know, for maintenance work, for getting rid of cellular debris and stuff like that, and get the body ready for the next meal. So timing of food intake really is important. And that brings us also to the whole intermittent fasting literature and all the diets that are out there on intermittent fasting. And so what we and others also found is that people that fast for a longer period of time and are eating most of their calories earlier during the day have less feelings of hunger. And we did a study in people with obesity who lost about 6% of their body weight, and they ate the same amount of calories and lost the same amount of weight. That was the study design. The only difference between the two groups really was whether they were eating most of their calories early or later in the day. And the people that ate most of their calories early in the day showed differences in the brain dopamine system. So we really think that timing of food intake is an important determinant of body weight. And if you're trying to lose weight, it might help to eat most of the calories early in the day and not eat after 8 p.m., for instance.
So listen to your grandmother and your mother and say, eat a good breakfast. Start your day with a good breakfast. It starts your metabolism. And I think it's interesting, too. My dear husband is probably an old vaudeville joke, but I'm on a seafood diet. I see food and I eat it. I want to eat it. And then the visuals, as you say, are so important. And time of day, that's why we read articles that say people that work night shifts or round the clock shifts are, they're hungry. They think they're hungry, or they see food, or somebody brings in a tray of cookies for all the staff or something. And you're going to be eating when at another point you'd be asleep and not interested in that food. So the visuals are such important cues, hence marketing. You know, you open a website to order something, and the delectable meatballs or the cookies and the cakes, and right? The visuals are so important, especially for animals too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely, because our brain gets triggered. And of course, we're not just our brain,
right?
But we all get triggered by food cues, and it really depends on whether you're in a more hungry or more satiated state, how the brain reacts. But these reactions are clearly different in people with a different body weight. So the other just to finish up on you mentioned the environment, and I think the environment we're growing up in is really important to learn to make the right food choices. Socioeconomic status, unfortunately, is also a determinant of obesity and genes. So it's very rare that one gene is responsible for the occurrence of obesity in a family or a person, but those rare cases are there, definitely. But mostly obesity develops as a result of our environment and our genes together.
So chances are a family, if there may be something genetic, or maybe they're all eating the same lunches and dinners and exposed to the same foods. Let's take a little break and hear about this week's Real Champion, and we'll be back with more from Dr. Murray Serley. Now for your Real Champion. I call this segment Diapers for Darlings. Spring is here, that wonderful time of year when we feel renewed. The days grow longer, the air is warmer. A time of year when we celebrate new beginnings with flowers blooming and trees turning green with new growth. That's why the symbols include baby chicks and baby bunnies, all signs of new life, renewal, and hope for a fresh start. A time when we plant our own personal seeds by setting new goals and aiming to follow our dreams because the cold and dreary winter is now behind us. So when a woman learns that she's going to be a mother, it should be a joyous time. There's no greater gift than welcoming a precious new baby into the world and looking forward to embracing an innocent new life and showering that little angel with love. But for some women, the news makes them feel frightened and alone because they're impoverished, or maybe they can't afford to leave the job that supports the family they already have. This is where we can help. For many of us, buying a bag of disposable diapers doesn't cause a big strain on our budget, but for a disadvantaged mother who uses several bags of diapers a month, it can be quite a struggle. So, your radio doctor is sponsoring an event called Diapers for Darlings. We're inviting listeners to support needy mothers so they don't have to make a choice between buying diapers and buying food. Diapers are the one commodity that can be costly. All babies need them, and they don't have an expiration date. It's easy to help. Visit the website www.yougivegoods.com. Scroll down to find an event, then in the search bar, type Diapers for Darlings. Then click on a gift. Buy a bag of diapers or baby wipes. It's that simple. This streamlined process takes your donations and sends all diapers and supplies to Catholic Social Services at 17th Street between Race and Vine in Philadelphia. Now be assured that the diapers are distributed to mothers and families of all faiths. What these moms have in common is the need for our help. We'll be collecting diapers all during May and April, so take a minute to share a few dollars that will make a big difference. Help a needy mother comfort, nurture, and love her new little darling, because every life is precious and every day is a gift. Join our campaign to celebrate new life. Here's the information again, and we'll also post it on our social media sites and our website, yourradiodoctor.net. To donate, visit yougivegoods.com, scroll down to find an event, then in the search bar, type Diapers for Darlings. You'll be so glad you did. We salute all of you who help needy mothers. You're real champions.
Today's edition of Your Radio Doctor with Dr. Marianne Ritchie, presented exclusively by Independence Blue Cross, can be enjoyed anytime, anywhere, at your convenience. Just download the Odyssey app and search Your Radio Doctor. It's health education on demand.
At Independence Blue Cross, we take care of the people who take care of you. Everyday heroes like firefighters, police officers, teachers, farmers, and healthcare workers. Doctors and hospitals across the region have IBX, and they know what it means to have reliable access to care. So whether you're saving lives or just trying to live a healthier life, count on IBX, the region's number one health insurer for 85 years. Learn more at IBX.com.
Your radio doctor, Dr. Marianne Ritchie, now Saturday afternoons at 5, presented exclusively by Independence Blue Cross.
This program is paid for by Your Radio Doctor, LLC.
Welcome back to Your Radio Doctor. We're learning so much about the brain and how it affects our eating habits. Marie, we're talking about your recent research that found that people with obesity may have a decreased response in the brain to sensing that food is even in their stomach. That explains why some people can take in too many calories because they don't sense the food that's in their stomach. And then along the way, they have trouble losing weight and keeping it off as well.
Yeah, so we're wondering how the brain reacts to food in the stomach and the intestines, and whether that would be a different response in people with a healthy weight versus people with obesity. So what we did, we directly infused either glucose or lipid or water as a control condition, first in people with a healthy weight, and then we scanned their brains, and we use a method called functional MRI. And that's a neuroimaging technique where you can actually assess brain activity in areas you're interested in. So when we infused these nutrients into the stomach, and it was 500 calories, so that's like a relatively big breakfast, I would say. We found that in multiple areas in the brain in people with a healthy weight, we're changing their activity. And actually, the activity in all those areas went down, and which we thought made sense, because if food, you know, reached the stomach and the gastrointestinal tract, then there's no need to go and search for more food or eat more food. So those brain areas were all slowing down in activity. But when we did that same experiment in people with obesity, we did not see that response. So we measured for 30 minutes. And in those 30 minutes, there was no change in brain activity. Suggesting that there is a mismatch between what's happening in the stomach and what is sensed by the brain. So somehow the brain is not sensing that food is in the stomach, which then could lead to overeating.
Mm-hmm. So that's fascinating, because as you say, we are just... It's so great to have curious people like you, and you have the clinical exposure to, you have boots on the ground. You're talking to everyday patients, and that's not just all theory and in the lab. Because then we ask the question, if environment plays a role, and you're in a situation where you're surrounded by junk food or whatever the situation, or your family is more like, is maybe a little less directed to healthy food, does that chronic exposure to not such a healthy diet change your brain structure and make you less able to sense when you're full? And, you know, you take two groups of people with a healthy weight, people who are obese already or leaning toward it, and you put nutrients in molecular form, either fatty food or high sugars or just water, and you're watching brain scans, and the people with normal weight react the way you want them to. They say, okay, you're not so hungry anymore. But the people who are having trouble controlling their intake, their brains aren't signaling them to stop. They're saying, yeah, keep going if you want. You know, if you want to watch another movie and eat some more popcorn, go for it.
Yeah.
That's what you're saying. And there's so many, it's such a spectrum, I guess, because what's chicken and or egg? Is that brain mismatch there already, and that's what leads to obesity, or does environment and developing bad habits at an early age change brain structure and let that mismatch happen? Is that a good way to look at it?
Well, yeah, I mean, and it's a really important question, but we do not know whether we know that people, you know, certain people might be more prone to the development of obesity, but we don't know. We do not think that this is all, that people are born with, you know, a different brain structure that makes them so prone to obesity. We really think right now our environment and our food choices and the food that we're consuming is actually modulating the brain, so that it's a consequence of our eating habits more than a cause. So, you know, that's up for discussion. And the other thing is, when people, the question I get a lot is, okay, but if I'm going to lose weight, is the regulation of food intake by the brain, is that gonna, you know, be better afterwards? We don't know that quite yet, but what we did find earlier is that, that short-term weight gain, did not reverse these things we found.
Good.
But long-term weight gain, when we, for instance, did imaging in women that underwent bariatric surgery and they lost a huge amount of weight, and 2 years after surgery, we did the imaging again, we found that some of the dopamine changes, for instance, were reversed or partially reversed. So we don't know, does it take a lot of time or a lot of weight loss? We actually do not know what, you know, which strategy is the best to reverse these things that are happening in the brain.
And it's heartbreaking for people that do suffer from being overweight or even obesity. It's heartbreaking. They don't want to be overweight. And we're only having this discussion not to be able to say it's somebody's fault because of their environment. It's not that at all. We're trying to find out the answers, and are there cues for us to say, let's try this therapy or let's try that. So I hope that people understand this as a way to look at ways that we can help you help them. So tell us about the clinic. You go back to the Netherlands for at least 3 months a year and see patients. How do you evaluate a patient who comes to you and says, I'm struggling with my weight?
Well, first, I think it's you know, I compliment them that they really come, you know, to a clinic and address body weight, because that sometimes people are a little bit, you know, ashamed of addressing their struggle with obesity. So, but then I really want to know what their eating pattern is. What are they eating? Mm-hmm. Are they physically active? And what are they doing? Have they been snacking a lot? Have they been on these, you know, very low calorie diets a lot? So that all, what about their family history? To really get an idea, you know, what in this particular patient triggers the weight gain. Sometimes we also measure their energy expenditure to have an idea how many calories are needed for a stable body weight or for weight loss. And in some cases where, for instance, there is a strong family history or people are struggling with obesity since the age of 4, 5, 6, 7, so very young, you know, childhood onset obesity, we sometimes offer genetic analysis because that has consequences for treatment.
Mm-hmm. And as an endocrinologist and even as an internal medicine doctor, you will check thyroid. I mean, that affects your motor and how quickly you burn your calories and other basics. But I think, as you say, it's really important to emphasize that we really respect people who have the courage to come and say, I need help. And that's what this is all about, whether it's seeing a dietitian. And the other thing is, if somebody's really struggling with a large amount of weight that has to come off, it can be overwhelming to say, okay, here's the list. You're going to start exercising. You're not going to snack anymore. You get blah, blah. And they just say, it's too much. Do you ever talk to your patients and say, let's do a gradual change in your lifestyle. Let's try this for a month.
Yeah.
And let's get better at, you know, eliminating snacking. And then next month, let's add, do you ever treat a patient in layers like that?
Yeah. So, you know, I'm always trying to implement research findings from our own group and from other groups and try to explain to the patients with obesity about what's going on in the brain. And that sometimes you see this real relief, like, okay, I'm not crazy. It's not weird that I don't feel I just had my dinner. It's you know, so sometimes that knowledge helps them in setting new goals or how are, you know, their interaction with food.
Because it's out of their control. We feel guilty about things we can control. But if it's not in your control, we can identify and say, listen, this is not your fault. This is what we're finding. It's out of your control, but here's how we can work around it. Maybe that's and that's what you're providing so beautifully. So I think it's also very interesting that in the Netherlands, that when we talk about the new weight loss drugs that a lot of people are taking, maybe with good reason, maybe some are borderline, I want to lose 20 pounds before my daughter's wedding or something. We don't want to just jump into that because of two reasons. When we say, oh gosh, it's been around for, I don't know, you know better than I, 10 years that we use it for diabetes and helping with glucose control, and coincidentally they lose weight. But the doses that we use for strictly weight loss are much higher. And the other question is, do these medications respond or behave differently in people who are considered obese versus people who are just slightly overweight? They're the questions. It's higher doses. What are the conditions? How long do we use them? All those questions remain to be answered, because just like the COVID vaccines or any topic, we need a timeline to keep observing, collecting data.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, I think before we offer people to treat them with specific medications, there should always be a first attempt. And of course, people had like 100 attempts before they come to see you, but to really implement a good lifestyle change. And that really includes, you know, get rid of the snacking, don't eat after 8 p.m., try to make healthy food choices. And that kind of advice. But if you have to lose a lot of weight, then you need, like, you know, a second level of treatment, which might be either bariatric surgery or medication. I think the studies that are out there now with the higher dose of GLP-1 receptor agonist show that it's really effective in people with a BMI above 30 or people with a BMI above 27 with, you know, health, obesity-related health issues. We do not know what it does in people with a BMI of 25 that want to lose, you know, 10 pounds for a wedding.
So what's interesting in the Netherlands, the person has to document that they have done a year of lifestyle, consistent lifestyle changes before they'll be reimbursed, before insurance covers those medications. A couple of other things. We talked about circadian rhythm before. In the morning, we're up and perky, and then we fatigue later in the day, and our eating should sort of match that. And one of the things you say is do not eat after 8 p.m. I love that. People need specific parameters that, you know, I think that makes life a little bit easier. And if you say that people who have obesity versus lean people don't sense food in their stomachs, if they hear that, they're going to say, okay, I'm going to take that information. Here's what I can do with it. I could say, all right, I can eat two sandwiches and be comfortable, whereas my sister sits down after one sandwich, she stops. If I don't have that signal, I'm going to set a goal. Right. Set a goal when you sit down for your meal. I don't feel the trigger that says taper off. So I'm going to say, I'm going to try, see if I'm satisfied with one sandwich and a cup of soup or whatever it is. Set a goal. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. You might not feel the same satiety or pleasure from the amount of food you ate. But I think if you know, okay, this is enough calories for me, knowing that the brain is going to send you the wrong signals, that might help in reducing food intake. Yeah.
Beautiful. Let's take a little break. And when we come back, our wrap up called Your Weekly Prescription.
Your Radio Doctor with Dr. Marianne Ritchie is presented exclusively by Independence Blue Cross.
At Independence Blue Cross, we take care of the people who take care of you. Everyday heroes like firefighters, police officers, teachers, farmers, and healthcare workers. Doctors and hospitals across the region have IBX, and they know what it means to have reliable access to care. So whether you're saving lives or just trying to live a healthier life, count on IBX, the region's number one health insurer for 85 years. Learn more at IBX.com.
Welcome back to our final segment of Your Radio Doctor with Dr. Mireille Sarli. Mireille, we talked a little bit about things that add into the whole picture when you see somebody in your clinic. What about exercise? I know, obviously, exercise helps burn calories. Does that also affect parts of the brain that help with weight loss or weight control?
Yeah, so I think exercise is really, really important because it is beneficial for metabolism, but also for mental health, even independent of effects on body weight. So I think exercise should be always be part of any weight loss program or, you know, part of anyone's life, basically. But just losing all the weight you need to lose by exercising might be a little bit disappointing because I think people, you know, overestimate how much calories they're actually burning. And if you're going to the gym two or three times a week for an hour, that might not be enough to lose the amount of weight you want to lose. But still, it has magnificent, you know, effects on health, on our mental health, and it really also affects brain areas that are involved in food intake.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned dopamine being one of them. Dopamine is the chemical that, or the hormone, I should say, that affects so many activities, including cravings and addiction. So that makes a lot of sense. So we touched a little bit on the new drugs, the GLP-1 agonists. What did you want to mention as we close?
Yeah, so I think with the you know, we really are entering a new era of obesity treatment, and we know that bariatric surgery changed the landscape of obesity management. It's safe and it has great effect on short-term and long-term health outcomes. But we have all the new medication, and there's many more to come. But I think there are a lot of remaining questions, like how long are we going to treat people? Can we give them what we call a drug holiday, or taper them off, or lower the dose? How can we make these drugs affordable to anyone, you know, who needs it? And can we predict who will do well on those drugs and who will not? So there are a lot of open questions still remaining that need to be studied before we can, you know, advise people to take this drug or another drug, or to go into bariatric surgery.
Plus, do they behave differently in people who have diabetes versus people who don't? Do they behave differently in people who are markedly obese versus people who are slightly overweight? They're all, we need time. Time is the most precious commodity, yes, especially as a researcher. You just say, gosh, if I had another 1,000 people or another 6 months, it can really make a big difference in what you learn and your outcome. What's your take-home message for our listeners, Sir Mirai?
Yeah, so I think, you know, obesity is such a large problem for society, for healthcare, economically, and we all have a responsibility to fight this. So we, you know, need to educate people, educate kids about making healthy food choices, educate people about what specific nutrients are doing to the brain, and tell them that being in a high risk environment with food all around, how specific nutrients might promote obesity. I also think that that lifestyle management should be part of any obesity treatment, and more specifically, you know, I want to advise people that want to lose weight to track their timing of food intake. Try not to snack in between meals, and try not to skip breakfast. And if it doesn't work, if a lifestyle management alone is not going to do the trick, or people are regaining weight, don't be shy to talk to a healthcare professional about obesity, because it really shows that you are committed to your health, and there are solutions out there, but you have to go and talk about it.
So I love the way you outline that. Eat a good breakfast. How many times did you hear that from your mother or your grandmother? Do your best to avoid snacks, and don't eat after 8 p.m. Easier said than done. But if you have that oral fixation that you want to put something in your mouth, get a nice glass of water and lemon and squeeze it in there, and it tastes good. And it's not sugary soda, and it might suppress your appetite a little bit or make you feel like, there, I got through another night of watch TV. I know sometimes people will say, I don't watch TV on the first floor because it's near the kitchen, and I'll wander in there. I go up and I lie on the bed and I watch, you know, a sitcom before I go to sleep or something, right? It's all about telling your mind, I'm in charge, not you.
Exactly. That's well said.
Well, thank you so much for being our guest today. We've learned so much. And if people would like to come and see you, I guess they'd have to go to the Netherlands, but I'm sure that Yale Medicine has a great weight loss center and people that can advise patients.
Oh, definitely. There's an obesity management weight center, and people that are working there are aware of all the literature out there, and they're great doctors.
Well, this research is so fascinating and so logical. And I just want to thank you again for joining us today.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks again for listening to Your Radio Doctor every Saturday afternoon at 5 here on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT. Listen to any of our shows again on Audacy.com. That's AUDACY.com. A special thank you to our exclusive sponsor, Independence Blue Cross, and we enjoy our association with Helio.com, the medical media company and information platform that offers the latest in healthcare news and information. Visit Helio.com to learn more about weight loss drugs and the diet you should follow. Today's program marks a very special milestone for Your Radio Doctor. This is show number 200. We are so grateful to you, our listeners, and for the many sponsors who've made it possible to bring you this important medical information. Our numbers are growing, which makes us want to work even harder to bring you a clear understanding of medical topics that are common and not so common. Because what you don't know can hurt you, and you don't know what you don't know. So please follow us on social media and send a question to our medical mailbag. Let us know if you'd like us to mention your first name and your town on the air. Send it to info@yourradiodoctor.net. Also, let us know about a champion in your family, workplace, or community. Send your story to info@yourradiodoctor.net. Join our campaign to celebrate new life. Your Radio Doctor is sponsoring a diaper drive called Diapers for Darlings. Help a needy mother comfort, nurture, and love her new little darling because every life is precious. To donate, visit yougivegoods.com and in the search bar type Diapers for Darlings. It's that easy. We'll post the information on our website as well. And please continue to pray for peace in our world, our country, our families, and in each of our own hearts. This is your Radio Doctor, Dr. Marianne Ritchie, wishing you a happy, healthy, and safe week with the ones you love and celebrating that we have just completed 200 shows on your Radio Doctor. Always here to remind you that your health is your wealth.
Thanks for listening to Your Radio Doctor, Dr. Marianne Ritchie, presented exclusively by Independence Blue Cross. To contact Dr. Marianne and to listen to today's show as well as past shows, visit yourradiodoctor.com. This program is paid for by Your Radio Doctor, LLC. All opinions or statements expressed on this program are solely those of Your Radio Doctor and their guests and do not reflect the opinions of WPHT or Odyssey. Today's program has been pre-recorded.
At Independence Blue Cross, we take care of the people who take care of you. Everyday heroes like firefighters, police officers, teachers, farmers, and healthcare workers. Doctors and hospitals across the region have IBX, and they know what it means to have reliable access to care. So whether you're saving lives or just trying to live a healthier life, count on IBX, the region's number one health insurer for 85 years. Learn more at IBX.com.